Energy Transition, episode number 57. Our topic today is energy in China. It's a real pleasure being with Rinislav, Tami Nimet, David Blackman. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey.
Please let me share some charts. Oh, no, this one is better. Yeah, this one Tami brought to us. Let me put bigger to see. And Tami, if you wanted to talk a little bit about this picture.
Well, the Our World in Data is very good. It takes data from different sources and then creates these really great charts from it, which of course you can do if you have Excel installed on your computer or whatever, because their source of data for this particular one is the BP Statistical Review. And what's interesting about the BP one is that they've changed. Before they would have energy production by source as well as energy consumption. And in this year's statistics, you have to go into each individual one. So if you want to look at oil production or coal or whatever, you have to do it all separately. But here that with the energy consumption, I think what's most telling is the coal. So you have coal being this massive sort of wedge there compared to renewables, solar, wind, hydropower, nuclear, gas, and even oil's gone up quite a lot as well. But if you look at what China's doing, it's a bit misleading because, as you know, we were talking in an email exchange earlier this morning. The consumption by source doesn't necessarily indicate what's actually being produced. So if you have renewables that are producing, but they can't be, or they're being backed up by something else, and that something else has to get dumped, that's not indicated in here. It's only being indicated by what's being consumed, not necessarily compared with what's being produced. Does anyone else see that as well?
Yeah.
David, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Arena.
No problem.
Oh, no, I wasn't going to say anything. You go ahead.
Oh.
I'm marveling at the picture of China's energy consumption. It speaks volumes.
I mean, so this shows consumption, and so what it doesn't show is the capacity, the generation capacity either, of solar and wind that's been invested in by China, which they've made massive investments in capacity for wind and solar, but when you look at what they're consuming, the size of the bars, the width of them, remain fairly static starting in about 2015 through 2021, despite these major investments in new capacity. And what that seems to me that's telling us is that even though they're installing all this wind and solar, it's not necessarily paying off in terms of actual generation of electricity. And meanwhile, coal is just continues to expand exponentially. And I mean, we know they're permitting 1 to 2 new coal plants every week still. So that coal piece of that pie is going to continue to expand pretty rapidly in the coming years.
Yeah, interesting. There's another chart that's pay my attention. Only for coal consumption is a forecast 2025. Irina, you wanted to talk a little bit about this? See, China.
I'm not sure. I mean, this is self-explanatory. I mean, it's so clear that China is consuming literally as much coal as the rest of the world, if not a little bit more.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what are we doing? We're talking about the country with the greatest capacity, installed capacity of both wind and solar. We're talking about a country with massive hydropower resources and with fast-growing oil and gas consumption. Be that as it may, China is still consuming massive amounts of coal. Like David said, I don't see this falling, this demand for coal, anytime soon. On the contrary, it's growing because the Chinese economy is growing.
David,
yeah, it's instructive to me that this is based on International Energy Agency data, their own data. And to me, this chart and what we know is going to continue happening in China and India and Pakistan and Japan, which is now going back to coal and nuclear. Yeah. This chart right here shows the utter futility of the Western world continuing to sacrifice its economy and energy security for this energy transition. I you know, without India and China being willing and current now, right now, participants, it's just all an exercise in waste and futility. And this chart right here is the key.
It's impressive, this one.
Yeah. Right, especially when they talk about its global emissions. If it's a global problem and we're all supposed to be in it together, this chart tells you it's not happening. It's not happening the way they're saying. And they keep saying that if we lead by example, if Europe and the Western countries lead by example, China and India and everyone else will fall in line. This indicates no, they're not. Because they care about reliability and energy security, right, Irina?
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, they have populations of over a billion people. These people would turn on their governments like this if access to energy stops. But apparently this is something inconceivable or ingraspable for our Western leaders. So they're probably wondering why China and India wouldn't commit. Well, that's why, because coal is reliable, because oil is reliable, gas is reliable, up to a point, apparently, when we talk about affordability. And when you can't afford gas, you don't start building wind and solar, you start buying more coal and constructing more coal-powered plants.
Starting with David, please. Can we have an energy transition in the world without China?
No. And it's just is. To Arena's points about Western leaders being unable to grasp this, it was just over 2 weeks ago that Jennifer Granholm, our energy secretary here in the United States, was in Austin, in my home state, praising China for what it's doing on the energy transition. And, and saying that the West has a lot to learn from what China's doing. Well,
it does.
I mean, it wasn't what she meant, but yes, what we have to learn is that coal and other fossil fuels are what's reliable and what countries who want to have growing economies need to be relying more on and cleaning up rather than trying to eliminate. And I mean, the lessons here are so clear. It's hard to imagine how anyone who can understand what a chart is telling them can form any different conclusions. If you believe the governments of China and India and these other countries are rational actors, and I think there's no doubt that they are.
Good. Do you believe the same, Irina?
Yes. The governments of China, India, and the other developing countries, they are being pragmatic, because this is what this is what keeps you in power. Think of it this way: you don't want protests on your hands because of energy scarcity. We're seeing the protests in Europe already, even Europe, so far ahead of the social evolutionary ladder, if you like, democracies, the great democracies of the developed world, are facing protests because they have forgotten how important energy security is, as opposed to energy cleanliness or whatever. And emissions. These governments in Asia, China especially, because it's the biggest economy there, and it's been the fastest growing for most of the last 10 years or so, or 20 years, knows this better than anyone. And it is showing China has much more reliable energy supply than Europe at the moment, because it did not rush to close its coal-fired power plants as it was building all this wind and solar. And being pragmatic is the smart way of doing energy policies. This is what we are seeing in real life. You can like or dislike China, love it or hate it. I mean, I don't care either way. What I'm seeing is that China is being pragmatic. India, too, is being pragmatic. India, too, is building new coal capacity. Pakistan is doing it. Again, why nobody seems to be asking this question? Pakistan has scarce energy supply. It doesn't have reliable, stable energy supply. They had massive blackouts. Maybe they're still having them. So how come if solar and wind are so cheap, they're the cheapest, and Pakistan is largely a poor country, why didn't the Pakistan government start building wind and solar capacity? Why are they investing in coal capacity?
That's a very good point. And, you know, Michael Schellenberger talks about in his book, Apocalypse Never, about India and how the environmental groups had gone into India and promised all this solar energy and wind energy and so on. And eventually the people were rioting because they wanted to be connected to the reliable coal grid, because the renewables were allowing the village or the town or whatever to charge their phones for 10 minutes in a day. That's it. That's all the power that they had just distributed in the town.
And so iPhones need 2 hours to charge.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
I know.
The right? Charging with clean energy. Yeah.
Yeah. Get on a bike and start pedaling a dynamo or something. But you know, Irina's right. I think what's missing sometimes in this conversation about the energy transition, at least in Western countries, is the idea of national interest. Because it seems clear to me that the United States, Canada, the European countries, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, they've lost sight of what national interest means. What does it mean to have a prosperous people that, you know, and with energy security being a fundamental aspect of that? Pakistan, India, China understand that. It's clear they understand that. And the West seems to have pretended it doesn't matter anymore, that, you know, they've not thinking about national interest at all. And I think that's a real core element of the conversation that we need to be having, at least amongst the government officials that seem to be off on some other trajectory.
But this is why the climate movement wants these big decisions being made at more collectivist levels, multinational or even global organizations making these big decisions, because they know that the closer you get to the people, the less popular these policies are going to be, because they inevitably result in higher costs for energy and scarcity of energy. We just saw in Berlin before last, there was a ballot measure that the people of Berlin, you know, the capital of the Energiewende project, right, that it is supposed to be the most progressive climate change city in the world, voted down a net zero by 2030 measure by 82% to 18% of the vote. And that is, you know, obviously because they realized that, number one, it's not possible to achieve without going back to a 19th century style of living, and that their lives would become miserable as a result. And so, you know, it's not hard for individuals to understand this if the impacts are so immediate. But if all the policies are being made at these multinational and global levels, and the deadlines are way out into the future so that the people don't think there's any real immediate impact, or it's just going to be a gradual thing, they're willing to tolerate it. But if it becomes immediate and the choice is very clear, it's never going to be possible. I mean, popular with the people, and
or possible.
Or possible? Well, yeah. I mean, none of it's possible in reality. You can't repeal the laws of physics and thermodynamics. But as long as the impacts are not clear, they're nebulous, and the deadlines are way out, people are say, okay, that's not really my problem. But when it becomes immediate and they have to make a choice, you see what happens, even in Berlin. And I mean, you can imagine what a vote would look like in the middle of the lower 48 states in the United States. The votes in favor of something like that would be in the single digits.
David, but China is seems that financing, China, other countries financing coal plants like Pakistan, yes. Turkey. What's really happening in this case?
Well, I mean, China sees a way to make a return on an investment, right, from financing coal plants. And yes, they're doing it in a big way in Turkey and Pakistan and India and even in the Pacific Rim and Indian Ocean nations, Indonesia and others. And, you know, it's become a big business enterprise for China. I mean, you know, I'm not a China apologist or sympathizer with the communist government there, but they are rational actors. Look what they're doing with, you know, with lithium. Yet, you know, they understand that if they're going to keep building, you know, promoting electric vehicles to placate the Western politicians, they're going to need lithium. So what do? They go make a national level deal with Bolivia to develop some of the most massive lithium resources on the planet. So they're very rational actors in all of this. And, you know, they have a lot of money to invest. So they don't care between if it's coal or anything else. They're willing to invest to make money.
Are they investing to develop some factories outside the country and import the product after that?
Yeah, I think sure. with the lithium one, in the article I was reading from mining.com, they were setting up battery plants in South America. I think in Bolivia, maybe one in Chile, where they were going to use the resource that they're sponsoring the mining. You know, it's the Chinese companies that are doing it or whatever, paying royalties or however they're structuring it with the countries, and then setting up the battery plants to utilize that lithium in South America. So it's not just that some of it will be exported, but that they'll be utilizing it in situ, so to speak, in those particular South American countries. But if I could add to what David said about the financing the coal plants, my understanding is that China has promised they weren't going to fund any new ones going forward. I don't know if they're actually sticking with that. But
there were
a lot
of caveats to that.
Yeah,
but yes.
Right. But they were kind of filling a vacuum because the IMF and the World Bank says we're no longer going to fund that. We will only finance you developing countries if you go green. Right. And the developing countries are like, well, why do I want to go green when it's unreliable? So then China comes in and promises, yeah, we'll finance it. We'll send our engineers, we'll send our workers, and we'll build this for you. You know, you'll pay for it, but we'll build it for you. So, you know, they were going into a vacuum left by the Western countries with the IMF and World Bank saying they wouldn't do it anymore. So, yeah.
Well, and remember, too, that BRICS, the BRICS alliance, also has its own competing monetary fund that
right.
is designed to compete with the IMF. And that fund also has no real restrictions on funding fossil fuel projects like coal plants.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, it's brilliant strategy. It really is. And they're in clear competition with the G7 and the rest of the Western world. And the Western world doesn't seem to be aware of it.
not only importing energy, but establishing a new currency too. So this is something new, no?
Oh, yeah, they're really pushing the renminbi.
Yeah, and David, you can see that $1 means 6.89 Chinese yuan. So they
And the dollars remained, the value of the dollars remained fairly strong against other currencies. And, you know, there has been a kind of a spate of recent deals, international trades made in currencies other than the dollar. And it's lost a little bit of its market share. But, you know, I don't think we can say it's in a real collapse situation, at least right now. And, you know, from America's standpoint, we hope that that doesn't happen, because the economic implications of that would be pretty severe. But at the same time, China and Saudi Arabia hold an awful lot of U.S. debt, and a collapse of the value of the dollar and the petrodollar as the currency of mark would have pretty significant economic implications for those countries as well.
Do you believe that dollar can become weaker?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Could. Particularly if America doesn't get its arms around its debt spending. But, you know, as we saw with the IRA passage last year, Congress doesn't have much appetite for that either. So, yes, I think there's real potential for the dollar to weaken in the coming years, and potential implications of that are pretty rough for the, you know, inflation and other economic issues here in the United States.
And we
it's about the erosion of the confidence in it to some extent. Like, you know, people, when we talk about the rise of the petrol yuan and the sort of emerging trend, it's a trend of using the yuan in replacement of the dollar, or cutting the dollar out as an intermediary to some extent. There's people who are saying, well, the dollar still underpins the yuan to some extent. Oh, okay. But this is a gradual thing. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. It's something that builds up over time. And as confidence builds in the trading relationships between China and other countries and the different commodities that they're purchasing and goods that they're selling, it could replace the dollar at some point in the future, probably sooner rather than later. But, you know, it's not something that happens just overnight.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Irina, you wrote something today morning, I suppose, about OPEC plus a voluntary cut of 1.15 million barrels.
Surprise of the week.
And China increasing the consumption in the near future. So could you please bring a little bit about this, Tam?
Well, I was really surprised that some analysts said they were surprised by OPEC plus's move. There was nothing surprising about this move. I've been expecting it for a couple of months already. It was just a matter of time. What was surprising was that they didn't even wait for their official meeting on Monday to announce it. Yeah. They announced it a day earlier, giving me something to write about on Monday morning. On the face of it, this is not good for China, because China imports a lot of oil and OPEC Plus is trying to make oil more expensive. But then if we remember that Saudi Aramco, for example, set its official selling price for different regions of buyers, and it could always increase the price for Europe and reduce the price for China, because China is taking in more barrels. And then, of course, China has access to cheaper Russian crude, and Russia is also a member of OPEC Plus. And basically, I think that OPEC Plus and China and India are playing the West just very well. And the West can't really react. They need the oil. I mean, Europe has increased its intake of not just US oil, but also Middle Eastern oil because of the embargo. And while the West is going from one wrong suicidal move to another wrong suicidal move, I mean, OPEC Plus and Asia should be laughing. If they're not laughing at us, they should be.
And it isn't necessary to announce, because it was not an official decision, I suppose. It was voluntary, no?
Right.
Well, yeah, it's still official. I mean, the biggest producers in the group are cutting. Saudi Arabia is cutting another half a million barrels daily. That's a strong signal, and I mean, criticism from Washington wasn't slow in coming, but it wasn't very, very agitated. It was relatively polite. We'll see what they have to say next.
But does
I'm wondering what effect that has on the Russian price cap. Does that have any effect at all?
That's a good one. We'll have to wait and see. And remember that when all these, oh, the sanctions are winning, they're working, and Russia is selling its oil dirt cheap. They keep talking about the Urals blend because it's the best seller. But other blends, like the ESP or Sokol, I think, is selling way above 60. It was selling at $70 per barrel a month ago, last when I checked. So, yeah, working selectively.
But does it compensate to reduce production in terms of the gain in terms of price?
Well, we have to wait and see. It's only been a day. But prices are up by, what was it, $5 from Friday?
Yeah.
6% overnight. Right. We'll see where it goes this week. It never proceeds in a straight line, but I think the idea here is to get Brent back above 90 by summer and maintain it there, I think is what they're saying their goal is. So Brent was at 84 this morning, and 90 is not very far away. And if they get to 90, it'll be interesting if demand is continuing to grow.
Yeah.
When the price gets to 90, it'd be interesting to see what they do at their subsequent meetings, whether they agree to put more oil back onto the market to stabilize it at that level, or they just let it keep going up.
And David, do you expect more inflation in the United States because this increase?
Sure. Yeah. Gasoline prices are big drivers of inflation in the United States. And diesel prices in particular, because everything is transported, on diesel fueled trucks and trains. And so, it'll drive more inflation here in the United States.
Yeah, and then they'll increase interest rates because, inflation.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. Sure. It's a consequence. Even Brazil, because Brazil used some kind of comparison of international price to put the price here locally.
Yeah. So and so much of this goes back to the apparent intentional destruction of America's relationship with Saudi Arabia by this administration. I continue to fail to understand the rationale behind the Biden administration's ham-handed diplomacy related to the kingdom and the fist bump and all that nonsense. It's so counterproductive and self-destructive. It's hard to understand who it is among the president's senior advisors that think this is all a good idea, because it clearly is not.
They all look and sound rather incompetent.
Yes. So, yes, they do.
Incompetent. Yeah, that's right.
Grand Finale is here. Hi. Hello. Good to see you again. What are those in the West going to say after the incalculable trillions have been spent on this futile quest for renewable energy has finally been exhausted? Oops, my bad. They'll all be safely retired on their massive estates with the security walls around them.
While the rest of us are out there with our torches.
Right.
Saying,
it just goes back to our concept that we have the worst possible class of people making all these decisions on our behalf.
Which is why there hasn't been a referendum in Canada or the United States or the UK on any of these policies, right? I mean, it's, you elected this government and that was one of the million things on their platform. Well, people vote for a lot of other things besides, most people didn't really understand what net zero or any of this stuff meant 3 years ago.
No, and most people still don't.
And most people still don't. They have no idea.
Yeah,
until now,
they'll be forced to start from the standard.
Oh, Irina, can I ask something? So you wrote a really cool thing about litigation, the increase in litigation.
Oh, right.
And my sense is that this increase in litigation is for publicly traded companies. And so if you're China that is run, their oil and gas and hydrocarbons are from state companies, couldn't this litigation be considered a weakening of the West and allows more the ability for China to come in later and exploit those resources that these publicly traded companies will be torn apart by litigation?
Imagine that. I hadn't thought about that, but yes, it sounds plausible and logical, I think, because really environmentalists, the only thing they can do about China state or owned companies would be to protest until the last man standing to prevent Chinese companies from taking the place of, you know, disgraced public Western companies that have been sued
oblivion
within an inch of their life or into oblivion. Yeah, that's actually a pretty realistic scenario. It might turn out that way.
Very good. Okay, people. Was a great conversation, China, energy in China today.
Yeah, great.
And was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you. Y'all have a great week.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks. You too.
Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Bye.